Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. As we're recording this with our able technical assistant in late December here, we just had a large blizzard-type snow come up the East Coast. Where Brother Mike is from, there's snow on the ground. Where I'm at, there's snow on the ground. And even where Danny's at, we got snow on the ground in Maryland. So winter time is certainly upon us here. And with that in mind, we thought we would wrap up our 2009 year with kind of doing both a retrospective and a looking forward, a retrospective of some of the events of what happened in 2009 that made an impact on the fire service and the apparatus industry, and then kind of almost like a Mike and Tom wish list, which we'll cover after the break, of those things that we would like to see happen during calendar year 2010. So, Michael, to start us off here, I guess the single biggest thing, and it's maybe because I had been working in the apparatus industry, but the things that impacted the fire service and the apparatus industry for this past year certainly is the impact of the economy and what that did in the fire apparatus industry itself. You know, as we've kind of talked about and alluded to in the past, that for the last couple of years, if we roll back to 2007, 2006 going into 2007 rather, a lot of departments were able to pre-buy apparatus, kind of bolster their fleet up a little bit in anticipation of what was coming down the road with the 2007 EPA engines from both a technology and a cost standpoint. And that, I think by all accounts, was pretty successful. If we were to break down the records, it's kind of like looking at your win-loss record as you're, you know, approaching the end of the season. 2006 and even 2007 were not bad years in terms of the total number of apparatus purchased in the United States. In 2008, kind of began to follow along with what was going on with the economy, and the apparatus industry was down a little bit. And this year, by all accounts, we're down double digits, significant double digits in this year. And as Mike and I have talked before, with the rising cost of apparatus due to the EPA regulations, some changes with the NFPA that occurred in 2009, despite the material cost that occurred in 2008, and then just the general impact of inflation on our economy here in the United States. And that's doesn't make any difference where you live. You can be living in Hawaii or Alaska or any one of the lower 48. Our economy is not real strong, and that has subsequently made our apparatus industry not strong. Mike, I'll flip it over to you for a second and a comment, but last night it really hit me. Wife and I happened to be watching one of the Sunday night news programs, and they covered goings-on in the town of Wilmington, Ohio, where at one time there was a large carrier of mail and express mail-type packages. That carrier went out of business, took almost 10,000 jobs out of the economy in that town, and that entire town, population to population, person to person, real faces with real names, is really struggling. And that, to me, was really kind of bringing it home. That's a microcosm of what's going on in our country. And for those listeners that think that, you know, you just paid X amount for a fire truck and the fire truck guy is going to now walk down the street with $100 bills, you know, falling out of his pocket and he's making a gang load of money, I can assure you, having come from that industry, that there may be some isolated cases where that might be the norm, but more often than not, those folks, the mechanics, the salespeople, the owners of the local sales distributorships that represent the major manufacturers and the major manufacturers themselves, not a lot of people throwing Christmas parties and throwing out holiday bonuses this year. The economy's tough, and that's really had a big impact on the people, the industry that we kind of rely upon to build the stuff. Mike, any quick thoughts on that?
Yeah, Tom, you know, just in sync with that, I know that you're not down here anymore, but in Pearl River, where Tom, not too far where Tom hails from, in Rockland County, there was a big laboratory there originally called Letterly Labs that's been bought and sold part and parcel over and over, that employs over 3,000 people, and they are going to lay off upwards of a third of their employees within the next several months, and it's kind of the beat keeps going on. But I think from an apparatus standpoint, the one that really struck me and was stark came out of, I believe it was Bridgewater, Massachusetts, where they put a 27-year-old fire truck, which was donated to the town, into service for less than $1,000. They accepted the donation, the town, of a 1982 Maxim truck that was refurbished 4 years ago and recently scrapped and ended up in a junkyard. The vehicle is going to replace the town's current engine, one, a 1992 vehicle, whose engine blew up last month during an annual inspection test. For less than $1,000, we're going to put a truck in service, said the chief. Replacement motor for the 92 truck, which has a $5,000 trade-in value, would cost $22,000. The chief called it a Band-Aid approach for the next 2 years until a lease on a 2007 pumper is done and the department can finance a new engine. But the idea that anybody would have to take a fire truck that's 27 years old, rescue it from a junkyard, and put it into service is, I think, just a symptom of a much more serious national problem as it relates to fire trucks and fire truck sales and the economy, you know, as a whole. I mean, how low can we go?
You know, Mike, that kind of rolls into our second item that we had, and your explanation of that particular description in that small department in Massachusetts just puts the exclamation point on it. But that was just a number of fire departments that had their budgets cut, so they were either on a rotational closing stations to alleviate overtime, or had capital expenditures, since we're just, not to say that staffing is not important. Staffing's all important. You can have all the apparatus you have in the world. If you don't have staffing, you don't have a fire department. But the number of departments that, for the second or third year in a row, had a capital expenditure up on as a line item on their budget for new apparatus or modifications to a station so it could take a new piece of apparatus, that just had those line items, you know, completely taken out, because just simply there is no money. You know, to amplify on Mike's point of what happened in that department in Massachusetts, department that Mike and I know very well in Ohio, was working to replace a 1977 pumper, and for the last couple of years they were told, yeah, we recognize it's old. They even had the folks from the city council come down and do a fire station tour and a walk around, and yeah, you know, when you can see the rust in the fender well, so you can put your finger through it from one side to the other, and given that the fact that the unit's 32 going on 33 years of age, it's probably reasonably seen the end of its service life. For the last couple of years, they were just told, geez, we're sorry, but there's other more pressing issues in this community, and you're going to have to wait. Well, so after waiting several years, in this particular year when it came up for discussion with the city council, they literally had to put all other capital expenditure projects in that community and put them on the back shelf. So there wasn't going to be any new dump trucks or snow plows or police cars or sidewalk curb improvements or septic sewer line improvements or water system improvements this year. The capital project in that fairly good-sized community that's well-supported with industry was going to be a single fire truck. And even that, the expenditure of that came under the budget microscope. So, you know, for departments that are down like that, not to say that they should entertain and look at buying a rig literally out of a scrapyard, as the example that Mike had. But, you know, there are alternatives to buying the new fire truck. We've spoken about them in the past, whether it's looking at refurbishing a piece of apparatus to make it safe, to make it street-worthy, to make it NFPA compliant. It might mean purchasing a used piece of apparatus. And again, tongue-in-cheek, not out of a scrapyard. There are still departments that are reasonably well-funded that are replacing 10, 12, 15-year-old pieces of apparatus, and that might fit your need. Your community maybe never even thought of purchasing a secondhand or a used piece of apparatus. Well, if your circumstances are such that you don't see a new unit in your immediate future, that might be a Band-Aid, but it might be your ticket to improving your situation from where you're at. And, Mike, to me, just, again, it's supposed to be a happy, festive time of the year here around the holidays. There's a lot of our brother and sister firefighters that have been laid off, as well as other folks in other vocations throughout our great country, and we would hope and pray that in the short term things are going to be turned around and our economy will start to improve. The little halo effect, as Mike calls it, that the fire service had after the events of 9/11 in 2001, that unfortunately kind of wore off very rapidly, because now we find ourselves as the fire service standing in line for that tax dollar with every other public funded agency in our communities. And while they view us as kind of important, there's a lot of other people competing for those couple of pennies on the dollar that come in via tax revenue. So on the other aspect, Mike, this year, and maybe you can point to a couple of, if there's any common thread here, but there certainly was a high number of apparatus-on-apparatus accidents, whether they occurred at intersections or at other locations. But this year we seem to almost write an entirely new separate chapter and verse on that. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's so true, Tom. As we go back and look back on 2009 into the latter parts of 2008, City of St. Louis, the City of New York twice, the City of Philadelphia, and probably the single worst out of all in the City of Houston, and that's where a deputy chief, a division chief, boldly spoke of racing to the scene of incidents and how this has occurred over time and how apparatus and drivers from different stations get into the race mode, trying to beat each other in to see who can get first water on that fire, if in fact there was one. So just very sad. A lot of equipment was damaged or completely totaled out, and a lot of lives certainly were changed forever. Certainly the life of the victim in the Houston crash, the civilian victim, and her family, and certainly prayers out for everybody that this occurred to over the course of the year. Just a tragic, tragic year. And when two of the intersections were equipped with preemption, opticon-type systems where fire apparatus actually had control of the lights and control of their own destiny, it's just absolutely unspeakable that this could happen in 2009. And when one unit is 2 miles from the intersection and another unit is a half a mile, and they both meet at the same place at the same time, you know, there's training issues there. There's supervisory issues there. There's just a lot of issues regarding those particular crashes that hopefully will get addressed in the days and weeks and years ahead, so that we don't have this just calamity of apparatus on apparatus accidents.
You know, Mike, and as sad as those events were, there is a there is somewhat of a bright spot in something that I know that you're intimately involved with. Is if you could update our listeners, one of the nice things that happened during 2009 that we've really got moving along thanks to the work of yourself and the people from the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation and just some excellent cooperation from the Montgomery County, Maryland Fire and Rescue Services and other large fire departments across the country, is what we're doing in the area of the progress on the seatbelt initiative and the and the studying of the actual physical makeup of the size of those firefighters as we don our bunker gear and operate on and about the fire ground. So what can you tell us with that?
Yeah, thanks, Tom. We have really been blessed. We started out 4 years ago with a dream, really, to try and improve seatbelts and firefighter safety. We had no money. We had really no direction, but we just knew that there was a problem and that we needed to try and get the problem solved. This year is the fourth year involved with this. We've had two previous studies. The first, again, with a lot of cooperation from Montgomery County Fire and Rescue folks. We measured by hand over 700 firefighters, which then led people to pony up some money for what was called a pilot study, where we body scanned 120 firefighters from across the country. And that information and that pilot study then led to a larger anthropometric study. And again, anthropometry is something that I didn't even know about or understand or could even say or spell, for that matter, several years ago. And now we are in the midst of this measuring of firefighters in their bunker gear, in their helmets, with their face pieces on, trying to get a handle on the different sizes and shapes that firefighters represent, and then trying to couple that information to get better apparatus seating, seat belts, rung spacing on ladders, which is going to come as part of a phase four that we'll get into in a minute. But bunker gear, bunker clothing, gloves, helmets, face pieces. We had originally got $1 million grant from NIOSH, which was awarded last year, and we've spent a year developing the methodology in which to gather information that would be helpful to the fire service manufacturers to make things that will be of better fit and safer for us. And then the first site that we chose was Montgomery County, Maryland, and we are supposed to measure 218 firefighters there, 219, excuse me, and the scanner was supposed to be there and the equipment until March 3rd. We just started December 2nd, and with the outstanding cooperation of Montgomery County and several departments around, including your old alma mater, College Park, we are way ahead of schedule of getting subjects in and getting them measured, and we're getting a whole variety of genders and ethnic makeups, which is really important to the study. So the scanner is going to be moved probably in February sometime to the city of Phoenix, and then it's going to probably go on to the city of Fort Worth or Philadelphia or vice versa. So as we go through times, we are going to be visiting those cities, and at the end of the year, we will have done feet scans, head scans, face scans, hand scans of 980 firefighters, and we will have measured by hand all of those 980, and then as a B part of this study, we are going to take 120 of the most varied subjects that we have as part of the 980, and they are going to get full body scans with and without their gear. The report and the information for this study is a four-year study that, like I said, began in October of last year, so we're a little over a year into this, and this is going to ultimately lead to a phase four study where we are going to do some more measuring and a range of motion and try to get a better handle on portable ladders and aerial tower stepping heights, stepping in and out of apparatus and handrails on the apparatus that will now be put based on this size and mobility of firefighters in their bunker gear rather than the methodology presently being used by the manufacturers. So there'll be a lot more purpose and a lot more safety involved with that. So just a lot of good things happening. Very proud to be associated. Gordon Routley, my partner in this, Jennifer Whitestone from Total Contact, who has just been a joy to work with and who has been constantly moving this project ahead. Dr. Hongwei from NIOSH, who is the PhD lead on this. And a special thank you to Chief Richie Bowers from Montgomery County Fire Rescue, has just been an ardent supporter of this project and has really just gone out of his way to make this first stop just flawless, and just really can't do enough for us. And just a big thank you to him.
Well, Mike, that's great stuff. The things we've been talking about here, of looking back in 2009, just because of everything else going on, not a whole lot of bright spots, and the fine work that you've done with Gordon and the aforementioned folks and National Fallen Firefighters Foundation is some real good things and stuff to look forward to, as they would say. The fifth and final thing, and kind of just to look back, and this is probably a little bit interrelated with the first couple of items that we discussed about with the downturn in the apparatus industry as a result of the economy and what the impact that's had on the fire service budgets, is certainly the impact of those government regulations. The Environmental Protection Agency, which if you think about impact that they have had in the fire service in the past, other than in some locations that I'm familiar with, have had a fair amount of impact regarding control burning and some of the training evolutions that we had previously been able to do in either a training ground or at an acquired structure scenario. The EPA certainly is here, and they're here to stay with respect to impacting the diesel engines that we utilize in our apparatus, and that was certainly brought to bear in calendar year 2007, and we are now literally days away from the impact of that occurring with the new regulations that take effect January 1 of 2010, and what that has done to both the engine manufacturers, the custom fire truck builders, and the commercial truck manufacturers, that everybody is going to be reasonably confident, somewhat struggling with as we move into 2010 and people build out their current production schedule with the current technology engines and move into the new technology. Like a lot of other things we've had to endure in the fire service with change to building construction and building codes and things that we've had to contend with in the past, I really haven't liked the word unfunded mandate, but this comes pretty close to it in my estimation, that once again we're going to be in the midst of, by any economic advisors observations, one of the worst downturns in the financial climate in our country, certainly in Mike in my lifetime that we're in or inordinately increasing the cost to do business, as they say, every day by having these things. So as you inhale and breathe the cleaner air, we can thank the EPA, we can thank Al Gore. It's not going to be doing a whole lot to anything for us from a practical application other than increasing our costs of operating, of purchasing, and more than likely probably maintaining our apparatus in the future. So we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back, and then we're going to spin the wheel around to the positive side, and Mike and Tom are going to give you some ideas of things that we would like to see happening in the upcoming year of 2010. So for Mike Wilder and Tom Shen, the Apparatus Architects, we'll be right back.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Hey, welcome back to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilber and Tom Shan. It's our end-of-the-year wrap-up show. We just covered some things that impacted us in the fire service and the apparatus industry here for the past 12 months, and now we're going to do our kind of looking ahead, if you want, the Mike and Tom wish list of things that we'd like to see go right in 2010. But before we launch into that, just a couple of quick things, a couple of upcoming shows and conferences that you might want to avail yourself of. The Fire Department Safety Officers Association is having their annual apparatus symposium in Orlando, Florida, from the 17th through the 20th of January. Having a very, very good, strong program this year with a lot of good speakers from both within the fire service and within the apparatus industry. And it's a very good, very intensive three-day conference. You might want to go check that out at fdsoa.org and take a look at the program. And both Brother Mike and myself will be speaking in a couple of different cases. And another just great training opportunity, Firehouse World, coming up in San Diego, commencing on Monday, March 1st, going through March 4th. A great opportunity out there, once again, to get a combination of both hands-on training during the Monday portion of the program and then a combination of inside presentations and seminars together with a pretty good display of apparatus and equipment. And for those East Coasters like Mike and myself, it's a real nice opportunity to see some of the builders and the manufacturers and the build-out of apparatus in the wildland-type units that are produced out there that you generally don't get an opportunity to see in too many other parts of the country. So two great training opportunities coming up there, January in Orlando at FDSOA and Firehouse World out in San Diego. And you'll both note, nice warm weather places to be in January and March as compared to where Brother Mike, Tom, and Danny, our faithful technician, and we're taping this today. No matter where you are out in it here in the East, you're looking at white stuff and it's cold. So great training opportunities and great communities, great places to be coming up. So looking ahead here, the Apparatus Architects wish list. I've got this out next to my stocking here, and we're going to see if Santa can make any of these things happen during the course of the year. And the first one is, and I guess largely as a result, if you look at what has been going on last year with some things, and we'll let Brother Mike talk to this, our first wish is that all fire departments would adopt a seatbelt and safe driving policy. And we've had some real good examples, strong examples of places where Mike and I have been recently, either at invitation of fire departments or working with those departments and training them, where they have adopted a seatbelt and a safe driving policy. But Lord knows there's a good number of us out there, and we would hope not anybody that's listening to the program, but a lot of other departments out there that just still view this as, yeah, it's nice to have, but I can't enforce it or I don't want to worry about it. So, Mike, how would you like to amplify on that one point?
Yeah, Tom, thanks. You know, a number of firefighters, again, were killed this year just senselessly and needlessly because they didn't buckle up. And, you know, part of it is this cultural change that the National Fallen Firefighters 16 Initiatives addresses, trying to get the culture to change and make people, make firefighters more accountable for their own personal safety. And nobody can, short of taking a gun, I guess, and going in the back of the cab, nobody can make somebody do something unless there's a certain percentage of buy-in by those that that it affects. And you know, that's what's so important about getting folks in this business to believe in just how important that their own personal safety is for everybody. We were asked to write a piece, and I'll try and find it before the end of the show, just a quote on what all that, what kind of safety stuff that you would want to see adopted for next year. And many places that you and I have gone to over time do have seatbelt policies. But that's only half of the issue. The other half certainly is to have some kind of strong enforcement. And I think that the choice is really stark and clear. Do you want to have this person around who's not wearing a seatbelt for the next run? And if you do, then you as an officer, whether it be a chief officer or a company officer, you know, needs to take some kind of action, whether it be, you know, I like you enough and I care enough about you where you need to take a rest for 30 days or 10 days or, you know, you need to give me a day's pay and think about putting a seatbelt on because the other, if I don't do that as a company officer or as a chief officer, then the only other choice is that at some point in time, if this goes bad, that I'm going to have to knock on your door and talk to your mother and father or your wife and children or significant other and tell them that you're not coming home. And I think for those people that are in charge of each of fire department organizations, I think those are really, you know, the two choices. Do you say something before the guy is dead, or do something or have some kind of positive impact so that they get folks to wear seatbelts, or do you want to just go knock on the door and tell his folks or whomever that this particular person's not coming home because they died in a traffic collision and didn't have a seatbelt on? The choice is clear. You know, what do you want for your department and for yourself?
Mike, two good points there. You talk about being the boss and caring for that person enough that you want them around. Chief John Salk, a couple of issues ago in Firehouse, wrote a really, to me, a column that just hit it out of the park, and it talked about being the boss. And then being the boss, meaning being the officer, didn't always mean being somebody's friend and covering up for them and, you know, kind of looking the other way. If somebody was taking something to go bend the rules, it was like, well, it's okay to go bend the rules. Just, you know, we'll get somebody to kind of cover for you. Being a boss, being an officer is not easy. And it doesn't always mean that you're going to be everybody's friend and run around and go and slap the back of the guy and just, you know, yuck it up all the time. Current issue of Firehouse Magazine under Harvey Eisner's editorial. At the press time of the publication, there are 80 line-of-duty deaths, and a number of those line-of-duty deaths were operating on and about apparatus or doing things or getting ejected from apparatus because they didn't have their seatbelt on. And I don't think there could be one thing that Mike and I is more important to us than all the things that we talk about, from beating one another up on engine versus truck stuff and who's more important and who should get on the fire ground first and equipment and all those other little things. If we don't have you around to help us staff the apparatus, then everything else we're doing is pretty much all for naught. It all boils down to safety
and your personal responsibility on that. So real good stuff there, Mike. Our second.
Got my quote here that I wrote for Pete that I think is going to appear online or in the magazine. Remember, folks, you are responsible for your own personal safety. So please wear all of your safety equipment provided for you, whether it be PPE, SCBA, seat belts, and ladder belts. Why? Because the taxpayers we serve deserve it. The fire department that trains you expects it. The firefighters that ride with you would like to ride with you another day, and the family that you left behind that loves you wants to see you return home in one piece.
Great, great stuff, Mike. It's all about safety, folks, and it's all about us, you know, coming back home at the end of the tour, at the end of the run, at the end of whatever the incident was. The next thing that Mike and I would like to see, just on a little bit broader issue, and this is, again, as a result of some of the folks that we've worked with, consulted with, helped out during the course of the year, is that if for departments moving forward that they develop and adopt a fleet replacement policy that has solid financial backing. If your department is operating and just going to the budget table and the budget hearings each year with a wing and a prayer, hoping that, geez, you know, I'd really like to buy an engine and a truck this year, and I'm going to see if I can, you know, the union back the mayor's run for office, and I know a couple of councilmen, and you got to go out and go play the political game. If your entire operation is working at that particular level and hoping that those things are what you need to do to pull out of your bag of tricks to make things happen, then if you're disappointed, you're probably going to be disappointed more often than not. We need to work with departments that no matter what the size of your fleet is, that you either do it yourself or get some outside assistance to do it, have your fleet surveyed, and then work with your community so that they have an expectation over when this your rolling stock is going to need to be replaced and that it does not come as a surprise. To me, Mike, if you go back and look at that community up in Massachusetts, and I know the New England area has been hit potentially a little bit harder than some other areas of the country with respect to funding of apparatus because of some of the existing laws that they have with respect to changes and increases in the operating budget from year to year, that there's an inordinate number of departments that have had to go out and either close a company because there wasn't any viable apparatus to staff it for the brothers to operate on. They've had to go out and look at, you know, putting a piece of apparatus in service potentially that was unsafe or had issues that may have caused the people to take pause as, you know, should we really be operating on this particular unit? And since apparatus from a budget standpoint, if you're operating in a combination department or in an all-volunteer organization, that could represent an awful lot on the bottom line of your budget. In a larger department that is completely career, the staffing and the overtime and the fringes and the benefits and everything, that's taking up the majority of your budget. And in a lot of cases, that amount, if you're going to still provide the same number of services and put the same number of people on the street, there's not a lot of room to play there. So, you know, if only 5 to 7% of your money is discretionary spending and your apparatus falls under that category, and that represents a large bottom line to that 5 to 7%, that's one of the first areas that people are going to look at and say, well, we need to cut. Well, where can we get $500,000? Well, we just won't buy that replacement for engine 4 this year. Let's put it off. Well, it's now, as Mike has said frequently, it's a pay me now or pay me later proposition. You can't cut that. You can't at the same time cut your fuel expenses and cut your maintenance costs and think that you're just going to take a 10% cut across the board. Something's got to give. And we have just seen a lot of departments suffer for the last couple of years because in some cases being treated unfairly by the community, but in other cases just didn't have the record-keeping system
and didn't have their act together in being able to support why they needed to be able to do something. Brings us to our third of our five wish lists items, and this is something, and this goes directly back to what Mike and I were talking earlier with respect to departments that had their budgets and their capital expenditures, you know, rejected. If a fire department, if you're lucky enough to get specifications promulgated for a new piece of apparatus, and from a technical standpoint, you haven't written your spec around a particular vendor, but you need to have certain components on the unit, and because of the way the market is right now, talking about the fire truck market, ladies and gentlemen, it's not uncommon at all that on a single pumper purchase, you can have a 50, 60, we've seen upwards of an $80,000 spread on a what would normally be a $400,000 fire truck, an $80,000 spread high to low. And what happens is the departments now kind of get, they're not really sure what to do. They don't get help, or they look at it and just say, I'm not sure what, you know, what's going on here. They don't analyze the technical part of the spec. They get swayed by the dollar value, and or the budget director or somebody comes in from the people who control the purse strings and tell the fire chief, Chief, I don't care what you ask for, but you see that low bid there? That's what you're getting, or you're not getting anything, because we're not going to spend more money when we see that there's, you can still buy a fire truck for $350,000, and the one that you're kind of telling me you want is coming in at $394,000. We're going to save that money, and you're not getting the $394,000 fire truck. Mike and I have seen just time and time again, departments just kind of almost throw up their hands at that point, that they're not sure what to do, or they just haven't had the experience yet. It's not that difficult to take the specs and start comparing them and get it either handwritten or up on an Excel spreadsheet and start seeing what you're getting for the dollar amount that the manufacturer is quoting you. I can assure you, if there's a $50,000 spread from high to low, the guy that's the high bid is not giving you the exact same thing that the guy that the low bidder is, and is not making $50,000 of profit at your expense. Those kind of margins just do not exist on fire apparatus. They probably never did, but I can assure you, given the tightness of the economy and the way the financial markets are now, that the people aren't operating on and just making that money as profit. So if you find yourself and you're in trouble, get help. You know, call the mechanic over. If you're not familiar with what's what in the spec or where to look for it, if somebody says, geez, I wonder if we're still getting that 400-amp alternator that we asked for, well, dive into the spec and read it. Yeah, we know it's tough. These specs can range from 70 to over 100 pages in length. And if you're not familiar with reading technical language or don't know where certain manufacturers put their stuff, again, get some help, but make sure that you understand what you're buying. Like most things in life, you get what you pay for. And that doesn't mean that Mike and Tom are out here stumping for the apparatus manufacturers and say, just always buy the high bid and you're going to be safe. We're not saying that at all. We're saying become an educated consumer. Know what you're buying for your dollar value, and know what you're getting. More importantly, know what you're not getting. Because the manufacturer and or the local distributor, if you had a bidder's comply column, which indicates that, yes, you agree to supply what's in your specification, and they check Y for yes, or vice versa, that you're not getting, you spec a particular size and brand of tire, but that manufacturer can't give you that, and he's now going to check no. We once again have seen more cases than not that people will just check yes in the spec. They might write a clarification, they may not in a couple of cases, and the onus is on you, the purchaser, to figure out what you're getting. And we would hope that a combination of departments would, in the future moving forward, stick to their guns when evaluating the bid responses and pay a little bit less attention to what the dollar value is in the beginning and look to see what you're getting from a technical perspective up front. And then you can go take a look and see, you know, what are you getting for your dollar value. Our fourth, and coming down here in the home stretch,
we would hope that moving forward in 2010, fire departments would emphasize in their training aspects apparatus operation. It goes hand in hand with the seatbelt policy and the safe driving policy to do whatever we can do in an effort to reduce the line of duty deaths. Brother Mike, I know you have, you know, written, spoken, going across the country in the majority of states over the course of the last 12 to 15 years doing EVOC operations, and in many cases just pouring your heart out and getting people to, if nothing else, learn from our mistakes. If we screw up, let's make sure that we don't do that one again. But how would you like to comment on that particular one?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Probably in the news right now, that still, after all this time, has legs. Generally, the news cycle runs in such a way that most news items, even in the fire service, are here today, gone tomorrow. But there was recently another article written on the tragic line of duty death of Lieutenant Kelly in the Boston Fire Department that occurred 11 months ago. And in that article, cited a couple of things that are still going on. One is that the vendor that did some of the repairs on the brake system, an outside vendor, apparently used the wrong parts. And then another thing that was highlighted earlier this week in a separate article, so there's two articles in 1 week, was just the lack of training surrounding the operation of emergency vehicles in the city of Boston. And Boston is not unlike a lot of other places across our great country. Driving programs that I've seen as I go across the country and teach range really the full gamut from anal retentive, ultra responsible, almost to the point of not letting people that should be driving drive because they're just so cautious. And then it goes all the way to the other end that's just saying, you know what, here's the keys, jump in, start it up, and have a nice day. And so the programs run the full range. But we need to concentrate more in the year ahead on training people properly on how to drive these units. The units have gotten bigger, faster, heavier, more expensive. They're so much more technical now than they've ever been. And yet the 20-somethings that we're getting into the fire service have never, in most cases, driven anything bigger than a Toyota Corolla or a pickup truck. And now we have them tooling down the road in something that weighs 40, 50, 60, sometimes 80,000 pounds. And it's almost a recipe for disaster. So we need to spend more resources and more time training folks. And training can take on a variety of connotations. It doesn't need to be some big, expensive, extravagant program, but just simply those that know how to do, teaching those that may not know how to do. In just a common sense, straightforward, lot of hands-on type training may be able to help start bridge the gap between those that know how to do this very important job and those that don't.
You know, Mike, of all the things that we go out and that we've written about and talked about, the baseline is to be able to do things better, smarter, easier, but ultimately safer than what we're currently doing. Look at your 4 years of effort that you and Gordon and the folks at National Fallen Firefighters Foundation have done into the seatbelt. Those are things that we're looking at, what we're doing today, today's equipment, today's technology, and looking at it and making it and improving it so it's better for the next generation, so that at some point we can reduce and hopefully eliminate the painful injuries and line-of-duty deaths that we experience every year. And that ultimately is what we are looking to do. And all of that rolls in to our fifth and final apparatus architect's wish for this year, that whether we're talking about fire trucks, if we're talking about emergency vehicle operation, if we're talking about things that are outside of, you know, Mike's and my expertise, you're looking to investigate to buy new PPE, you're looking to replace and upgrade your SCBAs, whether it's equipment or a particular tactical operation that you want to investigate and then get into your department's SOPs. If you're not sure what you're doing, please get help. The fire service is universal. If you look at the number of just of excellent authors that put that routinely write columns and material in Firehouse Magazine, up on the website at firehouse.com, it's like we've got the encyclopedia of knowledge and talent literally at our fingertips. We can email people. We can pick it. It's old school. I enjoy Saturday Night Live. They did a little parody about these new iPhones. I know Brother Mike's got one that's got a whole bunch of apps. My cell phone looks like something that came from 1951. It's big, it's old, it's clumsy, and it's got big buttons so I can read what the number is without having to put my glasses on, right? We have gotten so technologically involved with all of these things that when we come across a problem, more often than not, we just try to, let's figure this out ourselves. If you've got an apparatus issue, if you've got a driver training issue, Mike's website, emergencyvehiclerresponse.com, it's got a contact form. You can contact us anytime. We'll do our best to get back to you right away. And if we don't know, we'll try to push you in the right direction for somebody that can go help you out. But with the pressures that we have, in with reduced budgets, with increasing number of runs and demands from our services, the fire service now, the latest moniker is, we are an all-hazards agency. As one chief down in New Jersey told me a while back, Tom, if it doesn't involve a gun, I guess they're calling us, all right? And as we certainly know in a lot of tragedies that have occurred throughout our great country this year, even if it involves a gun, the fire department is going to get called. So if you, your department has a particular issue or a problem, rather than having four people sit around the table and argue back and forth over whose point is more salient or who seemed to have done a better job in reading up on something, get help. Go out and seek the resources of folks that can assist you through your issues so you can move on to improve, to make your particular department a department that people are going to want to come down to, are going to want to come to work. In a volunteer organization, folks that are going to have a strong affinity for wanting to come to devote their time with no compensation, but most importantly, to take every brother and sister firefighter that goes into an incident during 2010, that we would hope and pray on behalf of Mike and Tom that those people would be brought back home safely to their families for 2010. So before we wrap up on a high note, we just would like to acknowledge two close friends of Mike and Tom that have aspired to greater positions. Our first is our good friend Ty Dickerson, who was the volunteer chief in College Park, Maryland, in Prince George's County. Ty is now the first new career fire chief in Lexington, Virginia, which I know over the weekend they found out what wintertime operations were all about, where they when they got hammered with like 18 to 20 inches of snow and found out that their brand new less than a couple year old fire trucks that do real well on dry roads, that they don't operate particularly well in 18 to 20 inches of snow, so they went old school and outfitted the brush truck to be able to go run alarms, and we're running an older pumper. So while all this technology is great, and even in a place like that, where I know some of the meteorologists were saying this was a 50-year storm, you don't have old-school snow chains that you can put on your tires and go retro, chances are your fire truck's not going to get from point A to point B. So now we could have 8-person staffing on the engine and 6 on the truck and do whatever we want. If we can't get there, we're not doing any good. And Chief Dickerson just did a great job in getting his department through a major snow event. And then a little bit closer to home, District Chief Mark McLeese, good longtime friend of Mike and Tom, was just the last week appointed to be the new fire chief in Syracuse, New York. Just a great department with a real great tradition in history. So Mike and Tom would like to give a big shout-out and congratulations to both Chief Dickerson in Lexington, Virginia, and Chief McLeese in Syracuse, New York, and wish them many years of good health and success and safety commanding those operations there. So, Mike, as we wrap up here, our program for last one for 2009, any parting thoughts for the listeners?
Yeah, I would just like to wish everybody out there a very Merry Christmas and a happy and safe New Year, and hopefully we can all come back home after incidents in the upcoming year, and that we will have a better, safer year in 2010 than we did in 2009.
All right. Mike, I just echo those sentiments, and to all our listeners, a very safe and happy Christmas and holiday season, and safe operations going through the holiday season and moving into the new year, and we look forward to working with folks and being able to see you out on the road at some point during 2010. So for Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects, holiday greetings to all, and wish you safe travels, and whatever you do, be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.